welcome to the last Funds Fan podcast of 2021. It is also, I am sad to say, the last time I'll be joined by Tom Bailey for this first segment of the podcast. Tom, who has been the ETF editor at Interactive Investor since last August, is heading over to Han ETF to head up their ETF content. For the first couple of episodes of the podcast next year, there'll be various people stepping into Tom's shoes. But before he heads off to pastures new, for one final time, let's chat through the latest fund and investment trust news. So Tom, as this is the last podcast of 2021, I thought it'd be a good excuse to look back at how things panned out this year. So let's start off with predictions that were made at the start of the year. Now, making a forecast is a bit of a mug's game, but nonetheless, it's interesting to write and read about. And in terms of predictions, a number of fund managers were bigging up emerging markets to be the best performing market at the start of the year. But as we now have the benefit of hindsight, we know that this did not play out. In fact, investors were once again better off favouring the US market.
Yeah, it's a kind of, as you say, this year's going to be a good one for emerging markets. The idea was obviously vaccines being rolled out, lockdowns being lifted, reaching some sort of end stage of the pandemic, the economy's recovering. This was spoken about as the so-called reflation trade, so the kind of the pickup in economic growth and activity. And according to many investors, a good way to play this was for emerging markets, which are seen as kind of a bit of a cyclical value play and kind of would work well with this kind of economic recovery. So December 2020, there was a survey from the AIC that came out, which found that of all the regions investment trust managers were bullish about for the coming year, this year we've just seen go, emerging markets were top. But of course, this trade has not worked out. So obviously it depends where you date the numbers to and when people are listening. But broadly, we can say that the MSCI Emerging Market Index has kind of been flat to make it a small loss so far this year, at least in sterling terms. And in comparison, the MSCI World Index, which is an index of developed economies, has returned kind of around 20%, a bit higher in sterling terms. And obviously a big chunk of the MSCI World Index is the US. And as you say, the US has really been the place to invest in this year. The US markets hit several new time highs. So, you know, despite the kind of change in the economic outlook with the kind of reflation trade, US market was still the place to be, as it's been for the last 10 years.
And in regard to emerging markets underperformance in 2021, a major headwind has been the underperformance of the Chinese equity market, which was predominantly due to political interventions that happened in the summer months.
Yeah, so as you say, China's been characterized by this kind of sense of political risk growing throughout the year. So we had the tech crackdown, we've had it extend to other areas of the economy in terms of the education sector. And then also we've had the other kind of risk around Evergrande and the attempts to deleverage China's economy. But all this kind of weighed on China's equity performance, particularly some of the big companies that make up large parts of the index, Alibaba, Tencent. It's kind of social media tech platform companies, which had, you know, these were some of the biggest companies in emerging markets at the start of the year. And then just more broadly in terms of China, at the start of the year at least, was I think just over 40% of the MSCI Emerging Market Index. So its poor performance this year has been a massive drag down on the general performance of the MSCI EM index. But it's not just been China, although you can trace some of it back to China. But the so one of the other biggest constituents is the MSCI South Korea index. That's been a big drag on performance too for the broader EM index. So it's Brazil. And then you've had other kind of emerging markets which have done better. India's been quite a good performer, but none has been able to kind of really outweigh the poor performance stemming from China and then these other places such as Brazil, South Korea.
And in regards to political risk in China, I've interviewed a couple of Asia and emerging market fund managers lately, one of whom was a guest on the previous episode of the Funds Fan podcast. Both the managers I spoke to, JP Morgan's Austin Foray and Aberdeen's Hu Young, made similar points in saying that the interventions by China's government into the technology and education sectors is a reminder of the political risks that are part and parcel of investing in China rather than being a new radical change. Aberdeen's Hu Young said that he is convinced China has not killed off enterprise and innovation, and he went on to add that in his opinion, China has been one of the most innovative of countries as far as technology is concerned over the past 10 years. And these comments, they were echoed by JP Morgan's Austin Foray. He said Despite China having a political system that's very different to what we see here in the West, fortunes have been created in the Chinese equity market in the last 20 years. Tom, it's been a difficult year for funds and trusts that exclusively invest in China, as well as emerging market funds and Asia Pacific funds, which tend to have significant exposure to the region, typically ranging between 20 to 40%. How have exchange traded funds fared?
Yeah, sure. So obviously ETFs kind of tracking the your usual MSCI EM index or maybe the FTSE emerging market index. I've not performed pretty well, obviously in line with performance of the indices. China Pacific ETFs, you've seen quite poor performance too, but particular one difference is, I think is always important for you to kind of keep in mind is, often if there's an MSCI, if it has an ETF tracking a China index, you want to work out, is it overseas, is it A-shares? So the A-shares are Chinese companies listed onshore. Now, a lot of the indices now have a mixture of A-shares and also kind of Chinese companies that are listed in places like New York. But it's been those companies that have been listed in New York, the Tencent, the Alibaba, that has really performed the worst. So you can find some China ETFs which haven't performed so bad, which are just really focused on the A-shares index, which is domestic listed companies. And these are kind of old parts of the, you know, the Chinese economy. It's drinks makers, it's cement companies, this kind of stuff. But you know that part of the market has performed better. So if you did have just domestic exposure, you wouldn't have done just as bad if you had a kind of a broader China exposure that had, you know, these New York listed companies. And then also just in terms of ETFs, I think one interesting point this year has been the performance of the LIXIL Emerging Market ex-China ETF. So obviously, as the name suggests, this is basically, it tracks the MSCI EM index, but with China stripped out. So because of having no exposure to China in this regard, the ETF actually managed to record a gain of around 11% so far this year. Obviously, it's better than what the broader EM index has done. And so this ETF is kind of, it's languished. It's not been particularly popular over the last few years. It's kind of definitely not really popped up on the radar, I don't think, until this year. You start to see more inflows and start to get written about more. And I think it's quite an interesting product for people who want to try and gain emerging market exposure without China included. Now, this obviously might be because of the political risk and stuff you talked about, or people might want to just kind of have their China exposure done differently. They want passive in EM, they want to then buy an active fund for China, you never know. So it's quite an interesting ETF, I think people should definitely look into, have a look at.
Moving away from China, another prediction being made at the start of 2021 was that it would be the year for the value style of investing to shine, having been notably outperformed by the growth style of investing over the past decade. And at first, last November, when the vaccine announcements were made, there was a market rotation which led investors to favour unloved value sectors, the likes of the oils, miners and banks. The hope was that the vaccines would kickstart the global economic recovery. Value stocks tend to follow the economic ups and downs. So the expectation of a stronger global economic recovery led many investors into these stocks and pushed many of their share prices higher. However, the initial vaccine bullishness disappeared in around mid-June. And since then, growth shares have once again been outperforming value shares. And this was on the back of greater caution among investors over the post-pandemic recovery. And then that led many investors back to growth shares, including the famous US tech giants. Growth companies are viewed as much more resilient than value shares during periods of lower economic growth. And the data from FE Analytics shows that from 9th of November 2020, which has been dubbed by some as Pfizer Monday, to the 6th of December 2021, the MSCI World Growth Index has returned 25% and the MSCI Value Index has returned 26%. So it's been pretty much neck and neck since Pfizer Monday. And as I've mentioned before on a previous episode of the podcast, this just goes to show that it is prudent to own a mixture of both investment styles rather than having a lopsided portfolio that's heavily exposed to either growth or value. And lastly, just before you go, Tom, I've run the data for the best performing funds of 2021. So this data is up until the 6th of December. So obviously we're not quite at the end of the year yet. And just for a little bit of fun, Tom, what would be your educated guess in regards to the best performing fund? I'll narrow it down for you a little bit. I'll give you a clue. It's an ETF. Now that some of the ETFs are now in the investment associations fund sectors.
Well, it's kind of tricky. It's the ETF, but it's in the IA sector, because the IA sector ETFs are not really that. They're quite broad, kind of index tracking, kind of traditional index tracking ETFs. So, because I would want to say a thematic ETF, but they're not really in the IA fund sectors, at least not yet.
Well, it is a thematic ETF. Well, sort of a thematic ETF. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
It's a sector one.
Yes, it's a sector ETF. So that invests in commodities.
Oh, okay. S&P energy sector.
No, I'm sure that's up towards the top, but it's the iShares Oil and Gas Exploration and Production ETF, which returned 72%. So I also ran the data for fund sectors, again from the start of 2021 to the 6th of December. So would you like to hazard a guess on what you think the top three fund sectors are?
IA Technology Communications, North America, and maybe UK small companies.
You got one out of three there. So in second place is IA North America, which has returned 22.8%. And in third place is IA Commodity Natural Resources sector. The IA is the investment association. But the top performing sector is the IA India/Indian subcontinent sector, which is up 25.7%. Perhaps that's gone a bit under the radar this year, how well the Indian market has performed, and obviously specialist funds have performed that invest in that region. And just going back to the overall top performers, the vast majority are funds that invest in commodities. And in terms of open-ended funds, the best performer was the Schroder ISF Global Energy, followed by the Guinness Global Equity Fund. They both returned 49.5% and 46.9%. And then lastly, let's move on to the sectors that were at the bottom of the table. So there was the global emerging market bond sector, which was down 7.1%. And then there was the Greater China sector, down 8.9%. But what do you think then, Tom, was the worst performing sector?
Well, there's definitely a theme here. So I'm guessing it's staying with emerging market related. So maybe a sub-region of emerging markets. So obviously got China, Latin America.
Spot on. Yeah, that's been the worst performing sector in 2021. The average fund in that sector is down 13%. For the next part of the podcast, I'm joined by Jonathan Davis, editor of the annual Investment Trust Handbook. Jonathan began his career as a journalist on The Times, Sunday Telegraph, and The Independent before qualifying as a professional investor. Jonathan also hosts Moneymakers, a weekly investment trust podcast. The podcast is published every Saturday, and in each episode, Jonathan is joined by Simon Elliott, who is head of investment trust research at Winterflood Securities. Both Simon and Jonathan chat through the latest news and developments in the investment trust world. Jonathan, welcome back to the Funds Fan podcast. It's been pretty much a year to the date since you were last on the show, and it's been another eventful year, to say the least.
Yes, what a year it's been. Absolutely. Who'd have thought that when we spoke this time last year, how things would pan out this year? Yet again, we've discovered that the majority of expert opinions and forecasts about what's going to happen don't turn out to be true. The markets are, someone once called them the great humiliator. They constantly confound expert opinion. But as it happened, it's been a very good year, as you say. It's been a fantastic year, in fact, for investment trusts. Performance has been good. Discounts have come in. And, it's been a good year to chronicle. It's the fifth year running that we've done the Investment Trust Handbook. And it follows a familiar format, but with a review of the year and some feature articles, Q&As, looking ahead, 50 pages of data and so on. And frankly, it's been a pleasure to produce this year. It's been nothing too bad to write about.
And could you pick out a couple of highlights from the newest edition of the Investment Trust Handbook for 2022?
Yeah, well, as I said, it's been a very interesting year. And I think if I had to pick some stuff out, I think We've got this 80 pages of data and how-to stuff. I've done a couple of how-to articles about how to research investment trusts and looking at discounts there in there this year. That's always very popular with the readers. But in terms of the themes in the handbook this year, I pick out a number of them. Obviously, the overall performance has been good. We've had record fundraising this year. We've written quite a lot about that. We've had, obviously, there's quite a lot of, in the interviews, quite a lot of interest in the UK equity market and how cheap that is looking. It's been very poor performer over the years in relative terms. That's a theme in there. And, of course, there's also the ongoing hunt for yield and so on, which we've written about extensively. So there's lots of good stuff in there. I would say that, of course, but I enjoyed producing it this year, as I said. And we had an interesting forum as well with some of the sort of leading pundits whom I talk to a lot. And they've got some interesting views about the year ahead. So, so far, so good. Next year, well, that's another matter altogether. And I say we're going to talk about that.
And there's a section on manager changes. And it seems to me to have become a bit more of a trend over the past couple of years in regards to investment trust boards being a bit more proactive in terms of making management changes and, you know, potentially firing a fund manager when performance is not up to scratch and in many cases changing the fund management group. Do you agree with that? And if so, what do you think is spurring boards into action?
Well, it definitely is a trend. I think I would certainly agree with you there. And I think the perhaps the most interesting aspect of that trend, there always have been, you know, trusts that go out of business because of poor performance or because they're simply not relevant. There's not enough demand for them. And in the longer term context, we've seen obviously a lot of institutions no longer invest in investment trusts. It's become more of a retail market. They tend to manage their own funds now. But I think the interesting part of the trend is it has actually spread to much larger companies now. We had three changes in 2020, significant ones with large investment trusts where the boards changed because of poor performance. And this year we've seen two more very large investment trusts change their management arrangements. That would be Scottish Investment Trust, which has gone to JP Morgan, or is going to JP Morgan, I should say, and Genesis Emerging Markets, which has... The mandate's been transferred to Fidelity. Both of these are very big trusts, and I think in the days gone by, it would have been a surprise to see trusts of this size, you know, lose their mandates.
Temple Bar, Edinburgh Investment Trust and Alliance Trust, they're three high-profile trusts that over the past couple of years have changed management group. The latter two, Edinburgh and Alliance Trust, also changed the way they invest and their investment sort of structure. What are your views on that trio?
Well, there are various, two of them obviously are in the UK equity income sector. That's Temple Bar and Edinburgh, or at least we're in the UK equity income sector. And the other one, Alliance, obviously is a generalist trust. What are my views on them? Well, Temple Bar is one of the trusts that I've added to the investment trust handbook that I produce every year for the handbook. That's a sort of broad-based portfolio that I monitor. So Temple Bar's gone in. I quite like the way that they actually stuck to their particular style. The manager is, the chairman of the trust is a very experienced investment trust watcher. And I think he took the view that despite the poor performance that was experienced under the previous regime, in latter years at least, and the retirement of the manager, Alistair Munday, they've stuck to a value style. And as I say, I'm quite positive about the outlook for that one. I think they've got off to quite a good start, and while they haven't shot the lights out, they're doing okay with their UK focus. Edinburgh, I'm not so sure. That's gone to Majedi, who also have a slightly different version of that particular style. Edinburgh obviously had a very poor track record in the latter years, again under Mark Barnett at Invesco. I'm not so persuaded by this one. I think I haven't spent a lot of time looking at it, to be honest. It's not in my portfolio and it's not particularly on my radar, though I have talked to the managers in the last few months. I think there are, to me anyway, some other more interesting opportunities in the UK equity income sector. And then finally, Alliance. Well, Alliance, it's interesting. I think one should see that in the context of what's been happening to these very large, you know, traditional generalist investment trusts, along with F&C and Witham would be the two obvious kind of peers, I guess. And, well, they've made a very conscious effort to, you know, to improve the performance and to make themselves more relevant. But, you know, the general trend, most of these trusts are having to buy back shares because they're trading at discounts. And I think there is a genuine question whether there is still a demand out there for that particular kind of generalist approach. I think they've done a good job in terms of the process. But the question is, are they still relevant for the, you know, for the 21st century? They've been around for a long, long time. But are these three trusts, including Alliance, are they still relevant?
That's a very good point. I mean, I think, as you mentioned, it's reflected in the, you know, the discounts. I mean, Temple Bar and Edinburgh, I think they both have had a turnaround in performance under new management. But both are trading on discounts. I had a look earlier, and as of end of trading yesterday, 7th of December, both those trusts are trading on a discount of just over 8%. And this is higher than the average discount in the UK equity income investment trust sector, which stands at 3.4%. And yeah, totally agree with the point you've made on Alliance Trust. There's not that many trusts that are operating under a multi-manager structure. So I think it is a good option for investors to consider alongside Witten and F&C Investment Trust, which you've just mentioned. Although with Alliance Trust, I think it's interesting that prior to Willis Towers Watson taking over, and they took over just over 4 years ago, the trust had an ESG strategy. And we're going to touch on ESG in a moment or two. But, you know, if the board stuck by that strategy, you know, the trust could have potentially been the leading investment trust in the entire sector for responsible investing, which, as you know, is very much in vogue at the moment.
Well, you make a very good point there, Kyle. I mean, ESG in all its various manifestations has become very much in vogue. A lot of demand from investors for funds that offer a sustainable or positive impact mandates. And, well, I think the Alliance story here is perhaps something one should think about. I mean, they sold the sustainable funds they had in 2017 when it had around 2.3 billion of assets under management in those funds. They sold them to Lowndes Trust in 5 years ago, and they now have 13 billion funds under management. The performance has been very good, and they have, Lowndes Trust have hoovered up the money. I don't think that the Lowndes Trust had the capacity to do that. Even if they'd retained those funds, I don't think they have the reputation or the marketing clout that Lowndes Trust has to take those funds to the level they have done. But yes, you're right. Of course, they when they adopted the multi-manager approach, the Alliance Trust decided to get rid of the sustainable funds because they were not regarded as core. Well, I think they got the future wrong there, didn't they? And ironically, of course, they had acquired those funds themselves 4 years earlier in 2013 from the insurance company Aviva. So this management team has been handled from pillar to post, if you like, but it's ended up in a very good place at Lowndes Trust. And I think it just underlines this issue that the question really is, what are these generalist funds like Alliance Trust for? I mean, they say they're fully compliant, they have an ESG process and so on, but they certainly missed a trick by disposing of those funds when they did.
So let's look back a bit more to this year. So you mentioned a few moments ago that, you know, performance for the sector, it's been another good year. And obviously, in terms of fundraising, it's been a record year for the sector.
It has, hasn't it? I mean, that's quite extraordinary. I mean, that would be the most notable feature of the year, I would think. I mean, the fact that the investment trust universe has performed on the whole pretty well, I don't think is a particular surprise. It's a very broad, diverse, you know, collection of investment trusts. And because the equity markets have performed well this year, you would expect them to do pretty well, and they have done. But the fundraising has been even more remarkable. I mean, the amount of money that's been raised this year is the highest since 2006, I think, just before the global financial crisis. And there is, of course, one has to say that one of the great features of the City of London has always been, like all markets, is that, you know, if there is demand for things, they will produce the supply very, very quickly, and they will go on producing supply until demand moderates. And so a lot of demand this year for yield, and therefore we've seen the huge success of these infrastructure and renewable energy trusts, for example, and some other newcomers to the alternative asset space. And the amount of fundraising has been, as I say, remarkable. A very, very good year for fundraising. One has to, of course, to wonder at what point that will produce too much supply to meet the obvious demand that is out there. But so far, not so bad.
Do you expect more of the same then in 2022? There's been a fair few renewable infrastructure trusts launched in 2021. Is it going to be more of the same?
Well, I think as long as the markets stay robust, then yes, I would expect there will be more attempts to bring to market. I mean, it's noticeable that I should say that 80% of the fundraising this year has been in the form of secondary issuance. In other words, this is by issuance of shares by investment trusts that are already listed, though some of those have been quite recent newcomers to the sector, it's fair to say. And that is a difference between 2006 and 2007, when we last had this sort of peak in fundraising. You have to say that the 2006-2007 precedent is not necessarily that encouraging, because, of course, it was followed by the global financial crisis. It was a very kind of bullish market environment at that stage. And a lot of the newcomers that appeared on the market then, you know, did not survive or did not perform that well over the medium term. But I think, as I said, if the market conditions stay favorable, I think we'll continue to see secondary issuance, particularly by those that are obviously by the ones that are trading at a premium, as many of the infrastructure and renewable energy trusts are doing. And that will go on as long as the market conditions stay, you know, the weather stays fine, if you like, for fundraising. There's no shortage of newcomers trying to get to market. We've only had a few IPOs, initial public offerings, this year because of all the secondary fundraising has dominated the fundraising. And people are being still very selective about the IPOs that can get to market. So, but it will continue, I'm sure, as long as the market stays, the weather stays fine, so to speak.
And finally, we usually have a fund manager guest on the podcast, and we ask them to reveal whether or not they have skin in the game. So I wanted to ask you, I'm assuming that obviously as someone who writes about investment trusts, that you do invest in investment trusts yourself. And I was hoping that you could name a couple of trusts that you own.
Sure. Well, one of the advantages of having been around for quite a long time is that I have managed to accumulate you know, quite a significant number of holdings in my SIP and in my ISA. I'm just like an ordinary investor in that sense. I have a SIP, which I manage myself. I have an ISA, which I top up every year and put money into, as everyone should if they can. And yes, I do own a significant number of investment trusts. In fact, in my SIP, I actually looked it up this morning. I have 19 investment trusts in my SIP, as well as six open-ended funds and a couple of ETFs. So if that's the answer to your question, I do have a lot of investment trusts. Now, that slightly gives a slightly misleading impression because some of those holdings are relatively small, and particularly in the property sector, where I have actually been adding over the course of the last year. For various reasons, which we can no doubt talk about. There's quite a number, and I want some diversification there. So I own half a dozen of specialist property trusts. But the biggest holdings, I can tell you that, they are Scottish Mortgage, you won't be surprised to hear, Smithson, the Fundsmith offshoot, if you like, a smaller company, Global Smaller Company Trust. And I also have a significant holding in Capital Gearing Trust, who I know is a trust that you've talked to on a number of occasions, Kyle. So those are my largest holdings. But what have I done this year? Well, I say I've added a number of these specialist property trusts, which I think in the current climate where there's concern about inflation and they produce decent yields and, you know, in things like logistics and social housing and so on, there are opportunities, I think, to pick up some interesting additions to the portfolio. I'm looking for them to produce some income for my SIP. And I do have a view that we are going to see better performance from what we call value stocks over the next few years because of potentially because of higher inflation and a number of other factors. So they all fit into that nice picture, if you can put it that way.
Well, in common with yourself, Scottish Mortgage is the biggest holding in my stocks and shares ISA, which I purchased around a decade ago and obviously been very, very pleased with the returns that that trust has made. Before you go, when is the Investment Trust Handbook 2022 on sale?
It's on sale from the 14th of December. So that is, 10 days before Christmas. You can get it from all leading bookstores, of course, and from Amazon. And there's also, we do offer this free ebook download. So you get 280 pages of solid content, if I can put it that way. I hope it's interesting. I hope it's helpful to people. I know a number of people have written to me saying they do value it every year. There's no kind of equivalent anymore coming out from the broker firms. They aren't really allowed to do that anymore, distribute them to retail investors. So we're hoping to fill a gap. And I'm sure listeners will be glad to know that I haven't written all of it. I've written a big chunk of it, but there's lots of other voices in there, including many of names that you will know. Richard Curling, Nick Greenwood, Alistair Lang, and a series of interviews with leading fund managers, including a couple in the equity income sector, because we were talking about that, which might be of interest. There's one with Murray Income and another one with Baillie Gifford UK Growth. That's not in the income sector, obviously, but it's a theme. The UK market is a big theme this year, and I think it's, I would say this, I think it's a good addition this year.
Jonathan, thank you for your time today. Really enjoyed speaking to you.
It's been fun. Thank you.
That's it for this episode, which is our last one for 2021. Check out ii.co.uk for our fund, investment trust and ETF content. In the next couple of weeks, there's going to be lots of articles that are going to look back to 2021. And then we're also going to look forward to prospects for 2022. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, please do give us a like and subscribe. I hope you all have a great festive break. We'll be back in the new year. And my next guest on the podcast will be Walter Price, who is fund manager of the Allianz Technology Investment Trust.